Turn to 2 Kings chapter 7. 2 Kings chapter 7. We have here, I've titled the message, Four Beggars Who Saved the City. The background is in chapter 6 and verse 24 and following, Samaria was under siege by Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. They went up to siege Samaria. And it was a terrible, terrible siege. We find in verses 28 and 29 that there was actually cannibalism. Women were eating their children. They were eating animal dung. And all kinds of unbelievable stuff just to try to survive. And in verse 31, then actually, in verse 30, it came to pass when the king heard the words of the woman. This is the one who said, give me your son. We ate my son, now give me your son. And the king heard the words of the woman. He spread his clothes and passed upon the wall. The people looked and behold, he had sackcloth. And he said, God do so and more to me also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand on him this day. So his life was actually threatened. Elisha had predicted that this thing was going to happen. As a judgment of God. Elijah predicted a drought in the time of a famine in the time of Ahab. There are going to be 7 years without rain. And right before the end of that famine, there was, of course, that big contest with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. My goodness, what a time that was. We sometimes say, well, I'd like to have been there, seen that. You know why we say that? Because we know the rest of the story. We know how it turned out. Elijah, I think he knew how it was going to turn out because he knew God. But folks, other people had no idea what was going to happen. God burned up water. And water doesn't burn. All right? It boils away. But God burned at that time. And so we actually have this being threatened. And Elisha sat in this house, verse 32, and the elders sat with him. And the king sent a man from before him. But ere the messenger came to him, he said to the elders, see how the son of a murderer hath sent to take away my hand? Look, when the messenger cometh, shut the door and hold him fast at the door. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him? While he yet spake with them, behold, the messenger came down unto him, and he said, behold, this evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? Then Elisha said, chapter 7, verse 1, hear ye the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, which is a very small amount of money, and two measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. Then this arrogant chief of staff, I guess we could call him that, this Lord upon whose hand the king leaned, answered the man of God. I sense a real arrogancy and pride. Kind of a put down of the man of God. And he said, behold, if the Lord should make a window in heaven, might this thing be? Boy, he's threatening God. If God can't even do this. Do you remember there have been people through history who said what God can't do? And you know what? Every time they say what God can't do, guess what? God does it. The Titanic is a classic example. The unsinkable ship. Listen, folks, anything that floats on the water can sink. Unsinkable. And the blasphemous statement was even God couldn't sink this ship. And God says, oh yeah? Just wait. And what did God use to sink the ship? A piece of frozen water. Piece of an ice cube. A big ice cube, but an ice cube nonetheless. And God sent the ship to the bottom. This guy says, hey, God can't even do that. And Elisha said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not eat thereof. You're going to see what I'm telling you is true, but you're not going to partake of it. And we'll find out about that at the end of the chapter. So, there, verse 3, there were found four leprous men at the entering in of the gate. And they said one to another, why sit we here until we die? I want you to notice a couple things. First of all, notice their plight. They had the disease of leprosy. Often the disease of leprosy is a picture of the spiritual disease of sin. The disease of leprosy affected the whole person. The disease of sin affects the whole person spiritually, inside and out. Your very thought processes are infected with the disease of spiritual leprosy called sin. And by the way, there is no one exempted from that disease. It is an international epidemic that affects every person on this earth. Because of their plight, because of their disease, they were denied being with people because they were considered as being unclean. You find that back in Leviticus chapter 13 and around verse 45 and 46. And so they were not to go out and mingle with people. If they were out in public, they would cover their mouth and cover their face and cry, "Unclean, unclean!" What about you and me in our spiritual sense, BC, before our conversion? The Bible says we're all as an unclean thing. And all of our righteousness, that's all the good things we do to try to please and satisfy God, are nothing more than worthless rags fit for the fires of divine judgment. So these men were diseased, they were denied being with people, they were displaced, they were placed outside the city. If they had a home within the city walls, they were not allowed to stay there. And so they were put out of the city, they were utterly displaced. Folks, there is a sense in which the unconverted person who is still sick with the spiritual disease of sin has been displaced. He's denied being with God's people. He's not a part of the family of God. And he really can't even be with the people. And people can come here and visit church, but they're not a part of the church family. I mean, people may even come, and understand what I'm saying here. People may even come and pull the wool over the deacon's eyes, the pastor's eyes, and maybe even become a member for the false testimony. But in their heart, they know things are not right with God. And certainly God knows, but there's coming a day, of course, when that will all be said. We have a description of their sin. Isaiah 64:6, where all becomes an unclean thing. And Adam, of course, Adam and Eve were the first sinners to be displaced from their habitat. They were put out of the Garden of Eden. You know why God put them out? Because God, when he put them in there, and he planted the garden eastward in Eden, he created all the things that are there. He created Adam and he put them in there to take care of the garden. And God said, "Be fruitful and multiply." How many laws were there on the books? How many laws were there, folks? One. Wouldn't it be wonderful if Congress could have one year where they only pass one piece of legislation? I mean, they went 8 years without being able to pass a budget, so I don't know. But anyway, the fact is, one rule, just one. Folks, if you play volleyball, there's more rules than that. I was at a camp one summer as a speaker, and I was playing volleyball with the kids. And volleyball can be a fun game, but this one gal ruined it. Turns out she was a volleyball coach at the community college. I never knew there were so many stinking rules in volleyball. It seemed like every time I touched the ball, I did something wrong. Man, just go back to your dormitory and let me hit the ball and pretend I'm playing baseball and hit a home run outside the park, you know? But it doesn't work that way in volleyball. Well, only one rule, folks. And God said, of every tree you may eat, except this one. By the way, there's no record that God put any restriction on the tree of life. Obviously, they had not yet partaken of that when they took of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because that's the only tree God put a restriction on. And once they did, their eyes were open, they knew that they were naked, they were ashamed, they made fig leaves, tried to hide their nakedness, and they tried to run and cover themselves when God came down, and God held them accountable and put them out of the garden. Why? Lest they eat of the tree of life and remain physically alive forever in this sin-cursed condition. You know, God saving them out of the garden, putting a flaming sword there to prevent them from trying to get back in, was not an act, it was an act of judgment and justice, but it was not an act of anger and hatred. It was an act of love and grace that mankind would not live forever in that condition. Folks, when you think about it, isn't death itself a blessing? That we don't have to live in this body, in this world system, forever like this? Listen, for the child of God, for the unbeliever, this world is as good as it gets. It only goes downhill from here. For the child of God, this world is as bad as it gets. It only improves from here. So we notice then in verses 3 to 5, their plight. They were lepers. They said, why sit here until we die? And notice they also said, why sit we here until we die? If we say we will enter into the city, then the famine is in the city and we shall die there. And if we sit out here, we shall die also. Now therefore, come, let us fall into the host of the Syrians. And if they save us alive, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall but die. Notice their daring here in verse 4. They said, listen, we have a choice. We can sit here and die. We can go into the city and die. Or we can go to the camp of the Syrians and we can take our chances. And if they kill us, we're only going to die. Maybe they'll have mercy on us. What a daring idea that was to go into the camp of the enemy. Notice in verses 6 and 7, by the way, verse 5 says, they arose up in the twilight to go unto the camp of the Syrians, and when they were come to the uttermost part of the camp of Syria, behold, there was no man there. They waited till it was near dark. I guess, you know, it's harder to see in the dark. And they didn't have all this night vision goggles like our soldiers have today. They relied on just natural eyesight and the natural light and everything like that. And so they go over the outer edges, kind of sneaking around, just kind of have a reconnaissance, I guess, and see what that's like. And nobody was there. So they get a little bolder, they go in a little further, and the further in they went, nobody was there. Notice their protection in verses 6 and 7. For the Lord had made the host of the Syrians to hear the noise of chariots and a noise of horses, even the noise of a great host. And they said one to another, lo, the king of Israel hath hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. And so they were stricken with a fear that went to the very innermost part of their soul. God sent, it was really kind of a bad dream, God sent them all this noise, and they thought they were being attacked by a bigger army than what they had. You know, in some, you look at ancient warfare, and it seems many times that the one who was going to win was the one who had the biggest army. They could lose more soldiers. It was kind of like that even in the Civil War. I mean, you look at the battles of the Civil War and the insanity of warfare. I guess they didn't know any better. They didn't learn much from the British. The British would just march along. They'd be in a single file. We'd fire. You couldn't miss. You didn't have to be a marksman to kill somebody. Just shoot the direction. They're so close together. Big pack, you're bound to hit something. You look at Pickett's charge at the Battle of Gettysburg. What a horrible, horrible loss of life from that very means of fighting. And so these guys thought that, you know, they got a bigger army. We're going to lose. We better get out of here. So God struck them with fear. And notice in verse 70, their enemies flight. Wherefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their asses, even the camp as it was, and fled for their life. God has a way, folks, of taking care of his own. God has a way of dealing with the enemy in ways that we don't understand. I have often said, you know, one of my weakest areas of my life, emotionally, I guess, is when it comes to mechanical failure and breakdown. I am a musician, not a mechanic. And I've had guys say, oh, Brother Lynch, you need to learn how to change your own oil. And I tell them, I'll fix my car, I'll fix my motorhome. You go put a new set of strings on my violin and tune it for me.
Well, I don't know how to do that.
Well, I don't know how to change the oil either. I don't want to learn. You know what would happen to my music if I got all the oil and stuff on my hands? You would never again hear the glasses. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd rather hear the glasses and play with the glasses than change oil. There was one time in Montana, I was driving at the time a one-ton Ford van. And I know the Ford stands for First on Race Day, but they do need maintenance, and parts do wear out. Sometimes things need to be replaced. And my water pump went bad. And I thought, how hard can it be to change a water pump? These guys are saying how easy it is. Don't you laugh at me. So I got some pieces of cardboard, laid it out around the engine there, and I crawled under there, and I started taking things apart and laying them out on the cardboard so I know where everything went back in. And guess what? I succeeded in removing the water pump. I took it down to Napa. I traded it out for a rebuilt one. And I went back, and I guess what? I put it back in. But something I sensed was wrong when it was all done, I had 5 or 6 parts left over. I thought, now wait a minute. Those parts came from somewhere. So I finally had to call the mechanic, come and take it all apart, start all over again because of this dunk off. You can't tell Spencer from Spooner. I'll never live that one down. Anyway, God, the devil hits me in areas like that, and he knows I'm going to get frustrated. But you know what I found, folks, over the past 41 years of being in the traveling ministry? The devil is kind of a bore. He always comes up with the same things, the same way of attacking, usually involving something mechanical. And he knows I can't fix it. I do have some extra parts on board in case one particular thing that's happened 3 times goes bad. I've got the part for somebody to fix it, and I've got the tools they can use to fix it. And I know where the part goes, I just can't personally crawl down the engine and reach it. And then you have that grease question again. So anyway, but you know, the Lord is unique in the way he provides for those needs. The devil just says, send him another, shoot him an arrow, mechanical problems. And God has the most unusual ways of caring for those problems. I never cease to be amazed how God puts me in the right place at the right time where there's somebody there who can take care of what needs to be done. And get me on the road, very seldom losing any time. And so we notice then the enemy's fear and their plight. Notice in verse 8, the provision God provided for these men. And when these lepers came to the uttermost part of the camp, they went into one tent and did eat and drink and carried thence silver and gold and raiment and went and hid it and came again and entered into another tent and carried thence also and went and hid it. So they're, man, we've hit it rich. These guys have left it all, man. And they sit down, they have the best meal they've had in who knows how long. And notice part of their provision involved rations or rations. They had plenty to eat and plenty to drink. In John 6:35, Jesus said, I am the bread of life. My friend, if you're here tonight and you have that spiritual hunger, that emptiness in your soul because you don't have a relationship with God, I'm here to tell you, the bread of life is on the table for you to partake of and find that wonderful salvation in Jesus Christ. Then notice not only did God provide rations for them, but riches. The gold and the silver. The gold and the silver speak of God's glory. In Ephesians 1, God has blessed us with all spiritual blessings in heavenly places. While we're here, take your Bible, please, and turn over to Isaiah 61. Let me just show you an interesting verse real quick. Isaiah 61 and verse 10. I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he hath, notice, clothed me in the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robes of righteousness, as a bridegroom decketh himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorneth herself with her jewels. Folks, we have traded off, if you please, the garments of our human works and human effort for the garments of salvation, the robes of his righteousness. He who knew no sin was made sin for us that we might be made the very righteousness of God in him. Then, of course, we find that God also provided raiment. And they went and took all this stuff and hid it in their tents and came back. And they came, got more, went and hid it. And they're getting quite a stash. But then something happens in verse 9. They're packed. Notice, then they said one to another, "We do not well." How so? We just had the best meal we've had in months. We now have more money than what we know what to do with. We've got so many clothes, we don't have to wear the same thing twice in 1 week. I mean, we can sit out there and we can be high class beggars, finely dressed beggars. We do not well. Notice what why they said that. Their conviction said, "This day is a day of good tidings. This is a day of good news. Jerusalem is starving. And look at all the food that's here. We do not well. This day is a day of good tidings, and we hold our peace." In other words, we have not shared this good news with anybody. I wonder if you're here tonight, you're saved, but you've never shared the good news of the gospel with anybody. You need to confess that and ask God to help you to do it. "If we tarry until the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. Now therefore come, that we may go and tell the king's household." And so they were under conviction. Hey, we've got our needs cared for, but boy, our fellow Jews in there, they're suffering unmeasurably, and we have the answer. We have what they need. It's all here. All we need to do is go tell them. And so they were concerned about this. I find it interesting. These guys are beggars. These guys were the outcasts of society. People didn't care much about them. Oh, maybe they toss a coin in their lap on the way out of town, but they had no real concern for them. They were just beggars. They were just human trash. These guys could have become bitter. Bitter against God for the disease of leprosy. Bitter against the people for the way they were ousted and treated as a virtual trash. And yet they said, "We do not well." They were maybe tempted to be selfish, but realized that it was wrong. Said, "We do not what?" In other words, they did not hold a grudge for being rejected. How many times do we, when somebody rejects us, we hold a grudge? Folks, listen, vengeance belongs to the Lord, not you and me. I know somebody said, I don't get mad, I just get even. Well, let God get even. He'll settle the score in a way that will have a whole lot more meaning than if you settled the score. They were actually concerned about their fellow man. Day of good tidings. And notice finally then their proclamation in verses 10 and 11. "So they came and called unto the poor of the city. And they told them, saying, 'We came to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there was no man there, neither voice of man, but horses tied and asses tied, and the tents as they were.'" They're telling him all the good things they found. And he called the porters and they told him the king's house. And the king said, basically, "This is a trick. The Syrians have paid these guys off to give a false witness." Well, we've seen that happen recently, haven't we? And they kind of rejected the good news. Isn't this sad, folks? The world is dying and in mass rushing to hell. And we have the answer, and even when we share that answer, 9 times out of 10, the response is negative. Like me, on my way to Spooner, thinking I'm going to Spooner. People think they're going to go to heaven. You ever heard the expression, "We're all going to the same place, we're just taking different roads"? Is that true or false? Actually, can I disagree that it's true? They are all going to the same place. Huh? You with me? It's just not the place they think it is. And like when my GPS was like a Christian witness. My GPS was like a preacher. My GPS was like a co-worker who knew the Lord trying to witness and say, "Turn from your wicked way. Turn, go back. And every time I came to turn where I could have turned back, I kept going, "The GPS is wrong. I'm right." People say, "I'm right, God's wrong." No, folks, God's right and you're wrong. And the only way you can get right with God is to reject your own way. Because He is the only way, the truth, and the life. And then, of course, at the end of this, the people went in there, they found everything, and all of a sudden the city is basking in more food. They know what to do with them. People were rushing in, and the God, He said, God Himself couldn't do that. He saw what had happened, but He got trampled to death by the crowd of people. So He saw it with His eyes, just like Elisha said, but He never got to partake in it because of His own wicked heart. Psalm 142. With us I close. Psalm 142, and we read these words. I looked on my right hand and beheld, but there was no man that would know me. Refuge failed me. No man cared for my soul. My friend, we have a responsibility. I know that the ministry of the evangelist is totally different than that of a pastor. That's why God gave some pastors and some evangelists. The pastor is a teacher of the word. The pastor is often likened to the shepherd. Well, if the pastor is the shepherd of the flock, guess what the evangelist is? He's the sheepdog. Nipping at the heels of the sheep, trying to get them back, trying to fire them up, trying to get them more solidly behind the shepherd. We have a wonderful opportunity this week for 3 yet remaining nights to invite unsaved folks. I'm planning. This is Tuesday, right? When you do this night after night, week after week, sometimes you lose track of the days. I'm planning the next 3 services to just preach evangelistic messages. They're not intended for the choir, though the choir will be blessed by them. Any child of God will be blessed by hearing the old story you've told again. But I'm doing this so you have an opportunity to bring relatives and family and friends and co-workers that you know are not saved, that they might be under the sound of the gospel. And the music is a wonderful way to kind of suggest, hey, come and hear the musical glasses. By the way, they're not cups. Our assistant pastor, church, about 1,000 people that agree, says, Brother Lynch really does a nice job on the cups. Cups is paper and plastic. Give me some glass. Some glass. Anyway, this can be a drawing card. Now, this is not a gimmick. I hope you don't take music as a gimmick. But it is a means of inviting folks and using it as a tool to interest them in coming and letting them sit under a gospel message as well. Would you pray that way? Would you work that way? And let's see what God will do in the remaining 3 nights of our service. Let's bow together.